Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 465th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also a professor at the University of Alberta. And today in the studio, we're going to delve into a whole new topic, which we've talked about before, but not for a long time. Jamie is here from beautiful, frosty Manitoba to guide us through. Jamie, why don't you introduce yourself to the audience?
Sure. Thanks, Mike. Yes. So I am an associate professor at the College of Pharmacy at the University of Manitoba, practicing pharmacist in family medicine. So I work at the Kildonan Medical Center in Winnipeg, and that's a family medicine teaching site for the Department of Family Medicine. So I get to spend a day or two a week working clinically with patients and then spend the rest of my time at the university with teaching and research.
And Jamie and I, we've known each other for years it's from a school perspective and professionally and all that sort of stuff. So he's done some great work in a variety of evidence-based stuff, and he's always very clever at putting things together, at least that's what he keeps telling me. No. But today what we're going to talk about, and Jamie, and I've done some of the stuff with Jamie over the last number of months, is looking at the whole concept of COPD and inhalers and everything, because it is a gong show out there. As an example, my dad passed away a few months ago, and he was I think he was 91. And he was a family doc, and he was a smart guy, knew what was going on. But he also had some emphysema, not from smoking, but just from, he did a lot of woodworking and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, the last month of his life, he had probably 15 to 18 inhalers lying around everywhere. He had no idea which ones to use. I don't think he was really using them. There was duplicates of everything. It was really very confusing. And I know you guys all have clinical experience of that sort of problem.
Yeah, we were talking just before we started that in my years of practice, I could probably count on one hand the number of patients who refer to their puffers by name, mm-hmm. versus the hundreds of encounters where the patients have referred to the puffers by their color. And that's for asthma and COPD, but they're generally the blue one, the orange one, the red and white one, et cetera. And so one of the things you have to learn as a clinician is the color of the puffers, because that is how the patients know them.
Yeah. And so what we're going to do is we're going to go over the best available evidence. We're going to try and put it all into a context and help people think about how we could use those. So why don't you start us off from the very beginning, Jamie?
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to. Yeah, if you look at those handouts of the inhalers that are available in Canada or in the province, whatever it happens to be, it's a kaleidoscope of different colors, and it's actually quite a pretty picture. And it's there's so much there. I think I'll start with an anecdote. I know you guys love anecdotes. Yeah. So when I was, this was back in 2007, I was working in intensive care in Victoria, British Columbia, and the TORCH trial had just come out, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, but it's by far the biggest trial that had come out in COPD, and it was 3 years long, which was also unusual. And I was on an elevator with a respirologist friend and colleague of mine, and I was picking holes in the trial and just feeling generally underwhelmed by it. And he said, you know, for my COPD patients, I just want to do something. And it has stuck with me for a long time, because I think we all just want to do something, especially for a condition that slowly progresses over time. there's not a lot that does remarkable work as far as the medications are concerned. And so it's a statement that probably all of us are thinking, at least subconsciously, we want to do something. But it gets really tricky when you start to look at the actual benefit of adding something on. And then, James, as you were describing with your father, with what is the burden that also goes along with that when you put that something in place for a patient, and what does that actually look like?
Yeah. And I don't think we need to say too much about this, but COPD is a crappy condition. Quality of life is sucky. I mean, that's an actual medical term.
But yes.
It's not
Merck manual, James. The Merck manual had that.
Yeah, exactly.
It was towards the back, but it was in there.
So it's tricky, and of course when there's lots of issues, there's always incredibly helpful guidelines, right, Jamie?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It's a good segue, James. Yeah. It doesn't really matter which guideline you look at. There's generally this stepwise approach to care, and I think it's generally assumed that if you have a step, then there must be a benefit. If you're going up, that means you must be right. Yeah. You're moving on up. So you're improving things for a patient, but obviously, we have to realize that that's not the case for the majority of COPD patients when they quote unquote move up a step, and we can go today through some of these steps. With when you start with a short acting bronchodilator and you move up to a long acting agent perhaps, and then you move to two of those, and then you go all in with triple therapy, I think that majority of people that don't get a benefit becomes a vast majority as you move from step to step. It's kind of this diminishing returns idea that, again, I'm talking about a population that's been studied, not necessarily the individual patient, but when we're trying to predict those things for our patients, I think that's what we have to realize.
Yeah, and this is one of these conditions where there's a couple things going on. Just like you said, I remember James was in a debate one time with a respirologist. It was staged as a debate, but the respirologist at one point said, sometimes we just want to do something for our patients. Very similar to what you were told in the elevator. He said that, like, as a clinician, you've got to do something to help them out. And it rings true of your elevator speech. And, I see it in practice. And then when we give them, you're going to tell us some of the small numbers needed to treat and the absolute benefits, how small they are. But in fact, when you give it, you also get the placebo effect. And James will correct me about it being a placebo effect, but you get the effect of the placebo group. Yeah. And that in itself can be impactful. So combined with the tiny incremental benefit you get, you can actually see an improvement in your patient that you can walk away with, they can walk away with feeling somewhat good about. But the true benefits of these drugs, as you guys have both kind of insinuated, is generally quite small and at best hard to measure. And we'll talk too about the host of outcomes that we use to try and identify those benefits.
Yeah, that's right. And I think this is one of those, we see this in a lot of chronic conditions, but I think COPD is a great example of where the distinction between statistical significance and clinical importance is rarely drawn when COPD is talked about, and especially when inhalers are promoted or landmark trials are published, quote unquote landmark trials, and that's a big problem in COPD. Yeah.
And I think what we can sort of start off with the we have, you know, the blue puffer, if you will, the short acting beta agonist, the salbutamol, Ventolin, albuterol, whatever name you want to put to it. You know, in my experience in talking to patients, they'll say, I don't know about any of these, but this blue one seems to do something.
And certainly in asthma, right?
That's, you know, certainly in asthma, and also somewhat in COPD. But,
sure.
And because there's no doubt in my mind, and the evidence is, although there's not overwhelming evidence, this is a medication that's been around for years, it does provide improvement in symptoms for some patients, even if it's just short term and so on, which is why it's almost always on, it's the very first thing in any guideline.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, right. I remember having a patient a number of years ago, and we were talking about starting a long-acting muscarinic antagonist for this patient. He was using a lot of ipratropium, and he started on the agent. He ended up deciding that was something he wanted to use, so it would just be a once-a-day inhaler. And he came back for his follow-up visit and said he was still using about four puffs of his ipratropium in the morning. And he said he just liked that because it felt it gave him a boost. And it's one of those things where you can't say, well, no, I'm not really sure it gives you a boost, right? It's one of those things where, he may have gotten that benefit. It certainly could be there. And even if it wasn't there, if that's how he felt he was getting his morning started, I'm not sure that I was going to tell him not to do that.
And actually, it's interesting because, when I was sort of being trained, we were always taught that for COPD, the ipratropium was better than salbutamol because it was drying and whatever,
yes,
mechanism. And that's just, it's not true. In fact, it's really hard to find any great studies comparing, sort of a short-acting beta agonist and inhaled ipratropium or an anticholinergic that shows that there is any real difference. So it's hard to say which one is better. But I think, most people, I think, consider short-acting beta agonists as the first line for COPD. And then everything gets crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think once you're going to that next step of whichever short-acting agent is chosen, when we look at the clinical trials, and obviously we're looking at quite a bit older trials now, mm-hmm. Because these longer acting agents have been around for a while. But we're looking at either comparing to scheduled dosing of short acting or PRN dosing. And there's a number of reviews, systematic reviews, a number of Cochrane reviews that have looked at this. And it's you can get a somewhat of a ballpark estimate of what numbers needed to treat might be, and probably looking at the number of patients needed to treat to save one person from having an extra one or more moderate to severe exacerbations. Again, moderate meaning you're going on antibiotics or a steroid on an outpatient basis, and severe generally meaning a hospitalization. And the ballpark is fairly wide because it really depends on what agents you're using, what you're studying. But for the most part, when we look at 6 to 12 months of treatment, it's somewhere between 15 and 30 as your number needed to treat to save one person from having one or more exacerbations.
And that's when you look at.
I was just going to say that's adding that's giving a long acting versus one of the short acting agents, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And in that literature, we can see that, specifically with tiotropium, because that was really the first long-acting muscarinic antagonist that came out, we can see numbers needed to treat for severe exacerbations of about, 35, 36. So it does take a number of patients to prevent a hospitalization, but we do see that in kind of these earlier stages where you're just making that switch to a long-acting agent. When you look at symptom scores, quality of life and dyspnea, and James and I have talked a lot about this in the past months or year, about that the majority of patients and overall in the clinical trials and in the systematic reviews, you don't actually see that the overall population has reached that minimum clinically important difference. And the transition dyspnea index is probably the most common score that's used for dyspnea. And when we've gone on little road shows to rural physicians and when I've given talks locally in Winnipeg, we often ask the group, what do you think, if it's an 18-point scale, what do you think would be a minimal clinically important difference on that scale? And almost always the audience, for the most part, says somewhere around 3. They'd want to see a 3-point change. And the MCID is actually about 1 point. That's been what's been shown in the studies that have looked at this and validated it.
And that's a minimally clinically important difference of 1.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's interesting. So this is a classic thing about what is, when we set targets that are James and I have presented on osteoporosis, and the same thing is, what do you think is the minimum amount of reduction in fracture before you'll take a bisphosphonate? And it's funny because specialists are a couple percent and patients are about 50%. Like, yeah. The difference is huge. And these minimally important differences, which is they vary when they're studied, right? So the next time it's studied, it might be more than one or slightly less than one. But when you ask people, it's often quite different. What they think is reasonable.
And so, you know, once we get off, once we get past the sort of the short acting agents and we add in a LAM or LABA, there does appear to be a benefit for reduction in exacerbations. But I agree with you, Jamie. When you look at it, patients may not notice any benefit, like from a quality of life perspective, with the caveat, exactly as Mike said, is when you do something, people will often say, yeah, I think I feel better. But that's part of the natural fluctuation of the condition. And it's one of the biggest problems is that this is such a fluctuating condition that, you know, it can be somewhat seasonal. It can be very, very dependent on a variety of different things. But, you know, in general, symptomatic changes are sometimes not even measurable.
Right. And the differences here, so the number needed to treat, just to put them in context in another way, that 16 to 30 or 15 to 30 is kind of a 3 to 6% absolute improvement. Mm-hmm. And the dyspnea score is maybe a 15% absolute improvement. But that's, as Jamie was saying, not the average person doesn't actually get that benefit over and above the placebo. So they do something which we've advocated before for doing a responder analysis to see if you can find that. And when you're looking at these outcomes, you're looking at somewhere between 10 and 15% of patients will get a clinically meaningful difference. But remember, as Jamie was indicating, that bar is pretty low for what's clinically meaningful.
So
yeah.
Go ahead, Jamie.
I was just going to say on that line, when you look at quality of life or health status, and the St. George Respiratory Questionnaire is this 100-point score that's used in almost any clinical trial that looks at health status and is in no way could be used clinically. It's just, it's way too big and complicated, but it's the one that's used, and a 4-point difference is usually described as the minimal and clinically important difference, 4 points on a 100-point scale, which seems really small to me, but that's what it's been set at for these trials. But when you, if you think of a 4-point difference, if a person has a health status score on a 0 to 100 scale of 40, a 4-point difference is different than someone who has a baseline score of 20 and you have a 4-point difference, mm-hmm. right? I don't know how to put myself in the shoes of a patient, but I would expect, those two examples are a 20% difference or a 10% difference in your score. And I would think that's different. And there have been some that have proposed that for people with severe COPD, that difference that's minimally important should actually be about 8, 7 or 8 instead of 4. So even that, there's a lot of variability in that.
For sure. These constantly change when they're remeasured. And some have proposed that that instead of giving an absolute number, it should be a percent based on your original score. So if you're, as you said, if you're 40 on your quality of life, then it would be a percent of that as a change. So these things are hard to nail down, but it is the closest we can get to actually figuring out how much better it makes patients feel. And you mentioned virtually none of these will be useful in clinical practice. They're just to give us some guidance to take the research and apply it to our practice.
And so we've sort of just touched a little bit on patients with, I guess, mild COPD, and even that is tricky to define. I know the guidelines attempt to do that, but maybe we could just talk about, so, you know, the mild, I think, if short acting beta agonist, and then, you know, possibly a longer acting beta agonist or muscarinic agent, so a LAMA or a LABA. But clinically, how do you guys differentiate between someone who's mild, moderate, and severe? Because that has lots of implications. I know the guideline has certain thresholds, but can we just sort of go through that a little bit? Because it is even that is tricky and nuanced.
Yeah, it is. It is really tricky. And I think for me, it's for the most part, it's based on how the patient is feeling, what they're able to do. I mean, if you ask them if they're short of breath, that's kind of a tough question. But if you ask them if they're able to go for a walk with their dog at the same pace that they usually could, or if they're able to go through their grocery shop without having to take some rescue puffs, I think those are valuable questions. I mean, there's obviously more to it than that. And I'll let Mike answer that too, because I'm not the diagnostician or the assessor in that way. As a pharmacist, I do some of that, but Mike, how do you approach that?
So as James was indicating, a lot of it has to do with the parameters on spirometry and pulmonary function tests. I don't particularly use that. I mean, when I get those results and they're surprising either direction, that can sometimes be a little bit helpful for me, but it's mostly clinical, as you've indicated, for me as well, Jamie. And so most of the time I do start with kind of a single puffer. I rarely jump to a double. It would have to be a very unique encounter, because I want to see how it's going with just a single one. I have skipped the short acting, or I've prescribed short acting as to augment a single puffer, single long acting puffer, but that's generally as much as I go. I usually, if they're mild and they're presenting to me and they can do most things, but they're having some cough or some shortness of breath with more significant activity, like cutting the lawn or something like that, or they're really having trouble even, you know, going for walks with their spouse, that kind of thing, then I might offer them just a short acting to start. But if they're getting more significant impairment in their day-to-day function, I just jump to the one puffer, one, like a single LAMA or a single LABA, and have them try that with the opposite. So if I gave a LAMA as the long acting, the antimuscarinic, then I would give some Ventolin or something like that as the short acting rescue on top of it. That's generally how I start. Very rarely would I go for the combination products right out of the gate. It's just, I guess it's my nature to not really give two drugs when I don't even know how one will work. So that's it. It's not so much as the severity, although I ask some of those questions. I actually kind of have a stepwise approach that I use, not necessarily following spirometry like the guidelines recommend.
And I think that's important, because even the spirometry is all over the place, in that there's a huge variation, and it's very, you know, it's effort dependent. It's dependent on a variety of you know, how bad they are at the time, if they're having an acute exacerbation or not. And I agree with you. I think it should be primarily symptom based and are you feeling better, but even that is a tricky thing to do. But Jamie, as you know, and Mike, I'm sure you know, that when it comes to these guidelines, many of the guidelines are sort of provide guidance as to which inhaler should you use, and base it on how many acute exacerbations have they had. And you know, there's different levels of, you know, have you had one exacerbation in the last year or two exacerbations in the last year, and that is one of the criteria that's used to suggest whether you should use double and triple therapy. And it's the guidelines vary when you look at different guidelines, but that's also one of the criteria, which is also a tricky endpoint. Like, Mike, I don't know, do you ask about how many exacerbations you have and use that as your criteria?
Well, in my practice in Edmonton, it was a bit different, right? Mm. Because we would have patients, those patients, when they show up in emergency, and particularly when they're admitted, they will be coming out on multiple puffers or combinations, at least, right, of long-acting puffers. But when they're coming to see me, the sorting out of exacerbations that are not hospital-related, so these guys would automatically, if they were hospital-related, they'd already likely be on some combination puffer,
right,
already,
right,
because yeah, that's yeah, what they would have got in the hospital. So when they're coming to me, their exacerbations would be pretty fuzzy, because you'd be trying to sort out whether that quote unquote bad cold or flu that I had, you know, last year or had earlier this year was really an exacerbation of COPD or this, and especially because you're just diagnosing it new.
Right.
So it's a lot trickier than the guidelines would make out. But if I was in the practice that I'm in here, and I actually did emerge as well, you might be sorting people out coming to the emerge and getting admitted for a short period of time into the hospital as their first diagnosis of COPD. And in those cases, yeah, they might end up on a combination product just out of worry that, especially if they look really sick in the emerge visit and the hospital visit, you might end up wanting to be more aggressive. But I think the majority of us in primary care are, the reason that we give combination puffers right out of the gate is because that's what's in the drug cupboard most likely.
Yeah.
And that's the sad truth. I'm going to be honest. Have I ever picked something, a medicine for someone because it was in the drug cupboard? Yes. Because I know how expensive the puffers are, and getting them started and maybe keeping them going on something from the cupboard is the only option for them.
Yeah.
So it's obviously like everything, James and Jamie, you know, it's so nuanced what you end up doing for every patient's a little bit different.
Yeah. And I think that's probably the best approach you can take, because even the, you know, the gold COPD guidelines, because they recommend, you know, a decision-making process of, you know, putting people on inhaled corticosteroids or not or whatever, based on a thing called what's called frequent exacerbators. And
yeah.
And, you know, that's... They define that as, have you had, you know, two or more moderate exacerbations, or at least one or more severe exacerbations in the last year, and then use that criteria. But I did a paper with a colleague of mine just in the last number of months where the variability in exacerbations is so broad, it's almost meaningless to use those criteria, because just because you've had two exacerbations in the last year in no way predicts that you're going to have more. It's really,
right.
It's so, mm-hmm. It's like any other guideline. Both you and Mike and you and Jamie both know that it sounds like we're being clear and precise and everything, but when you actually go and delve into it, it's really not a very good criteria for figuring out what you need to use. And so, but most guidelines will have that as their threshold for when you really start to ramp it up to the triple therapies, and it's fraught with problems, even though it sounds intuitively like it's got good common sense and is logical, but it's not.
Yeah, but it's also a desire, right, to provide more guidance, clear guidance.
Yeah.
And you can understand where it comes from. It's just, we know that, and we also know that the guidelines are often written for family practice and primary care, but the fact is that the patients who are truly frequent severe exacerbators are almost always in part managed by respirology. So speaking of what you were speaking of, Scott Garrison is looking at this very question, who's managed in primary care and that kind of thing. And they're generally the mild to at most moderate cases. Mm-hmm. We should just say quickly, though, what is a moderate exacerbation and what's a severe? I can do that, or Jamie,
go ahead, Mike. Should.
So a moderate in these clinical studies is generally something where you need corticosteroids, but you're still an outpatient. And some of the studies actually said corticosteroids or antibiotics, or both, as long as you were still an outpatient, and severe is generally an inpatient visit for an exacerbation. Now, Jamie, is that kind of what you recall about the studies as well?
Yeah, it's exactly. Yeah, it can be antibiotics and or steroids on an outpatient basis. Yeah, and then almost always it's a hospitalization is a severe exacerbation. Yeah. Yeah, it's the paper that you had put out, James, with your colleagues is, I think that is an important one, and it highlights that fluctuation. And when you look at the clinical trials, part of the reason the guidelines have said that when you have this number of exacerbations, you should be on this is because the clinical trials said you have to have this number of exacerbations to get into our trial to get this drug, right? And it's kind of a funny way of looking at things. And it makes me think the people, when they look at exacerbation histories to get into a clinical trial, they're looking over the last year. How many did you have in the last year? If we know that that is fraught with error, because it could be a good year, it could be a bad year, it could just be a regular year for that that patient, mm-hmm. they went on the therapies they came into the trial with because of that fluctuating history, right? And so it just, I think it just makes things a little bit messy, but it the guidelines seem to make it clear that because you have this many, this is the therapy that that is best for you. And I'm not sure that's true.
Yeah, and it sounds very common sense, but the tricky part is that variability. So it it you can function that way in clinical trials when you're dealing with, you know, thousands of patients, because you have to have a criteria. But you know, every time any people see patients like this, it's one person. It's not a trial. And so
yeah, with multiple nuances.
Yeah,
right,
and so that's where it gets very tricky. So you guys have probably noticed that we haven't gone anywhere but talked about mild so far. And
yeah, well let's talk one more thing.
Yeah,
Jamie, and then we'll move on to we'll bring you back for the next podcast. But yeah. It's what about adding the two? Because there's lots of talk now. Remember, everything used to be, and we'll get to this, combinations of one of the long-acting dilators with an inhaled corticosteroid. But only about 5 years ago, I think it was, that we started to get a combination LAMA-LABA. And how right. does that compare to either one alone?
Yeah, so I think this is, for me, the first sign of that diminished return, I think, at least the first obvious sign. And part of that is because we've had so many clinical trials that have looked at that, the dual versus the individual long-acting agent. And I used to, I continued to update slides when I would teach students and residents. And it was, at one point, it was more than 25 randomized controlled trials and multiple systematic reviews. And what we have is that number needed to treat to have greater than or equal to one moderate severe exacerbation is about 42. So that if you recall, before it was about 15 to 30, now it's about 42. And it's difficult to compare these because we're talking about maybe different study designs and older studies versus new, but certainly not looking marvelous. Mm-hmm. When we look at most systematic reviews on this topic, that reduction in hospitalizations disappears. So it's a non-significant change, non-significant finding. When we look at dyspnea scores and quality of life, those numbers are creeping up from the numbers that we would have talked about before with meeting that, being a responder, meaning they met that minimal clinically important difference. Those numbers start climbing for numbers needed to treat. So it's it doesn't look better. If anything, it looks worse than when you took that first step from short acting to long acting. You don't you get even less of a benefit now when you add two long actings together.
And so
yeah. So what was kind of 3 to 6% absolute improvement is now, for a moderate to severe exacerbation, is now down to kind of 2.5% absolute benefit. So just as an example of how that it's starting to decline.
Yeah, and so when you're talking about the number that always comes to my mind is that, you know, and you're going to call me just a negative Nelly, but 97 to 98% of people get no benefit over a year of using these, and I think it's fairly obvious. It's not difficult to know if in fact that is real or not, because all you have to do is look at the size of the clinical trials that are done in COPD. They are almost all above 1,000 people in them, sometimes upwards of 2,000-3,000 people in these clinical trials, and that's a dead giveaway that the treatment is not effective at all, or has almost no effect at all. Because
it's minimally effective.
Oh yeah, minimally effective. Because if you think if we had something that was really effective for COPD, these guys are really quite symptomatic, a lot of them, and if it really worked, we could literally study that in 20 people. And we could show a benefit if they were that effective. You know, if you look at the use of PRN salbutamol for people who are acutely short of breath from asthma, you almost don't need studies of that. It, you know, they just work.
Right? Yeah, the cohort would be kind of an all or nothing effect.
Exactly, right?
Observational study where how can you say that there's a a cause and effect relationship. One of the criteria there is an all or nothing effect. Yeah,
no, exactly.
So an example of that might be using epinephrine and anaphylactic shock. Yeah. Now, no one's going to randomize you to not getting it, but those people who for some reason couldn't get it versus those who did, you know, it has a profound effect. And so this, I think James insinuating that if it worked as good as epinephrine,
we wouldn't have trials of 1,000 people. So that's where, here's where it gets tricky is when you go, okay, let's say we're going to use a dual therapy. And so you start the patient off on it for whatever reason, whether it be, you know, you think they just have a lot of symptoms or they've had a lot of exacerbations. You cannot assess so there's two things you could assess, whether they have another exacerbation or their symptoms. Whether or not they have another exacerbation is almost meaningless because you what are you going to do? Adjust it based on the fact that they've had an exacerbation? I don't even think that's a reasonable thing to
do. It's kind of like the statin question, right?
Yeah.
So I put you on a statin and 3 years later you have an MI. And do I say, it's clearly not working?
Yeah, exactly.
You can't say that. You can say, God knows, maybe we stopped 2 MIs, yeah. Right? So there are trials where people have had like 6 events in a single trial.
Yeah. Yeah. So you can't use that as an endpoint. And then you go from a symptom perspective. So, you know, you talked about the changes in some of these questionnaires. They're usually on average less than something that is even minimally clinically important or that you could pick up. Yet the variation in symptoms is so broad. It's probably 5 to 10 times more variable than the change that you see on average. And so you will have a number of people who say, yeah, I feel a lot better on it. And some people will say, I don't feel any better on it. I don't think as a clinician you can figure that out. And I would say, I don't even know if a patient can, other than going back to the caveat when they will say the blue puffer worked. And that's where we're kind of trapped, I think.
Yeah, it's really difficult. And you and I have talked about this before in the past as well. When does a patient come to you for some help with COPD? It's when they're not feeling well, right? Mm-hmm. And so if something is prescribed at that point, knowing the ups and downs of COPD, chances are they're going to get a little bit better. Mm-hmm. No matter what you do, right? And so how do you assess that? And some have suggested, and I think it's quite reasonable to say, well, if you're feeling not great today and that's why you came in, it might actually not be the best time to start something new because we're kind of starting a therapy when one of the therapies is to watch and wait, knowing that you might get better. Now, that doesn't mean you're if they're in really bad shape. Obviously, that's a different mm-hmm. scenario. But and that's really difficult to do. I think that's why I bring it up.
But if they're in really mm-hmm. bad shape, you're using steroids and antibiotics.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. You know, so it's such a difficult thing. So, we've gotten to the point where we've talked a little bit about, you know, very minimal COPD, and then now we're getting into discussion about what do you do when people are having exacerbations and the quality of their life is reduced. And we've gone from sort of single therapy and talked about some of the numbers with dual therapy. I think why don't we call it a halt to it now, and then in the next podcast we'll start off with where we were with using a couple of inhalers and then figure out when do we go even with more inhalers and so on. Does that sound okay to you guys?
Yeah, and then we're going to talk about the addition of inhaled corticosteroids and harms with that and everything. Yeah. And Jamie, I want you to focus primarily on eosinophil count. So that's your task. Yeah.
Well, we'll talk about that because it's that, yeah.
I don't want to hear about symptoms or exacerbations or pneumonia. I just want to hear about eosinophil
count. I don't want to hear it.
You're looking for a surrogate. You want a surrogate.
Yeah.
That's what I need.
I just impress me with pulmonary function tests. That's all I need.
So there you go. You've got your two mandates for the next podcast.
So anything else any guys want to add right now?
I'm good.
Yeah. If not, why don't we just leave it at that? So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.